Now we're joined by the experts at ETF Trends and ETF Database, the world's largest independent ETF-centric source for top industry news, trends, and insights.
By keeping rates so low, that is in effect driving investor money into the equity market. They're not just telling you what positions they've got, they're telling you precisely what trades they've made. It's a little bit of a who's who of the corporate bond space.
Dave, this piece you wrote on volatility, I'll be honest, my head still hurts.
I imagine how mine feels after having to try to write it.
Well, I read this a couple of times over the holiday weekend, and then I followed that with a few beers each time. But look, this piece was titled Long Vol, It's Always Different. This is posted at ETFtrends.com. And let me just start with this. I'm curious, what was it that originally lit the fire for you to write this? Because this was a legit deep dive.
So this is sort of a continuation of the work that I started back in the GameStop era, if you remember in January when we all collectively lost our minds for a few days. And I started going down the rabbit hole of, you know, what possible influences there could be, not just to justify, you know, the specific activity we saw in that one stock, but what else is going on that has created a market where these kinds of things actually are starting to feel normal, right? We see these crazy sort of out of sample movements in individual stocks and individual markets, and we've become, I think, a bit inured to them. So I started doing a lot of research on understanding market volatility. And boy, once you start peeling that first layer of the onion on volatility, it turns out you got to go a long way before you find the diamond in the middle.
Yeah, there is a ton that we can unpack here. I guess I mentioned at the top, I did have a few takeaways here, so maybe we can go through those and then, you know, we'll see where that takes us. Well, you know, I think for me, one of the biggest takeaways was simply that we can't rely on historical data or calculations to predict the future. And I think everybody knows that intuitively, but we all want predictability, right? So it's very easy to become enamored with fancy models and statistics and ratios. Obviously, you walk through the different measures of you know, volatility. But I think largely because these things are based in math, that does give us a sense of comfort. And I felt like you were essentially saying, well, look, these different measures of volatility, they all have their own issues. And at the end of the day, none of them are going to tell us if there's a huge risk on the horizon that's going to blow up our portfolios. I guess, is that a fair characterization in terms of where you were heading?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, from an academic sort of finance perspective, really what we're concerned about is sort of expected returns, right? That's, as advisors, as investors, expected returns are all we really care about. What are we going to expect next year? Like, what does a normal year look like? And then what does a normal investing cycle, like the next 15 or 20 years, look like? And, you know, the entire financial advisory industry is built on helping investors predict and manage that very tricky question. What are my expected returns given a certain set of priors? And I think what we've gotten hung up on, I'll speak for myself, for decades, is focusing on what those priors are, right? So we can talk about, well, okay, what's my estimate for inflation versus your estimate for inflation? And that's the distinction between yours and my investment thesis. What I started to uncover here, and to be honest, I barely scratched the surface of this, is that regardless of your priors, the very math and models we use to manipulate those priors into a sense of expected return are themselves very suspect. That's particularly the work of one rogue economist in London named Ole Peters, who runs a website called Ergodicity Economics. And you know, fundamentally, he's just pointing out the fact that we built most of the math for modern economics and markets coming out of the Industrial Revolution and haven't really messed with it much since. And guess what? We've learned a lot since the Industrial Revolution. Maybe we should get better at math.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. And, you know, you look at some of these models, you touch on this in your piece, they make a lot of huge assumptions. Right. And you said the biggest of which is that returns and outcomes, they don't fall into a nice bell-shaped curve. It's not always a normal distribution. And I guess on that note, you know, the challenge here for investors is that we have to make decisions with this in mind. Right. We have to deploy money, obviously not knowing what the future holds. We can't put it into a neat model and have it spit out exactly what's going to happen. And you said in your piece, let me read this. You said, quote, no matter how much we plan for the future, all we have to work with at any given moment in time is what's in front of us. And that actually reminded me of a tweet that I saw last week from Ritholtz's Michael Batnick, where he said, quote, we're not talking about the biggest risk to the market because risk never tips its hand. It's not inflation or COVID or anything else on our radar. And of course, that's probably true, right? But because of that, you get into talking about how investors then look for hedges or protection. We don't like to have this uncertainty out there. I guess talk about that investors are seeking hedges and protection, and then maybe we can start heading down the path towards how all this might be impacting the markets.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the most fun parts of this whole experience was I got to talk to some of, you know, for lack of a better term, the luminaries in this sort of long volatility space, who are people like Mike Green, who is now at Simplify, and I think most people knew him from the Thiel Foundation and Logic Capital and all that, or Chem Carson on Twitter. He's sort of probably one of the mavens of this area. And they're all rather humble, right? You point out that, you know, it's always the unknown unknowns that come out to bite us in the ass later, right? That's, I think we all understand that. We all know the things we're not even paying attention to are in fact biggest risks. But when you talk to folks who are doing this for a living, they're actually even more humble about it than that. They don't think it's just that we're not paying attention to the right thing. It's that they're actually unknowable, right? That we never can predict the future. And therefore, if you look at the evidence, if you look at, you know, things like the fact that we've got enormous skew in the market, if you look at things like the fact that the tails of our market are in fact getting fatter, and I put up some great charts from Corey Hofstein on that front, all that means is that the way we're approaching allocating assets and making investments is probably based on 30, 40-year-old math with 30, 40-year-old assumptions about how our model should work, and is really underrepresenting both sides of the tails. And I think that's a really important distinction here. This is not about doom and gloom. This is not saying, oh my gosh, the market is so much riskier to the downside than everybody expects. It's also riskier to the upside than everybody expects. And that's how we end up with things like last fall, where we had these runaway growth spikes in certain classes of stocks. That's the new normal. So the question is, if we're expecting these big tail moves in the markets or in sectors of the market, how do you position a portfolio?
Well, let's talk about the answer to that question, because I agree. I mean, if the tails in the market are fatter now, whether both positive or negative, and, you know, we're seeing these big swings up and down, they're happening more often, they're happening faster. But again, these are unpredictable. What is an investor to do?
Yeah, so probably the clearest example I got was from a guy named Jason Buck, who runs something called the Mutiny Fund and co-hosts Pirates of Finance with Corey Hofstein at Newfound. And he's very much at the base of the coal mine here, working with institutional clients and helping them build what he calls cockroach portfolios, portfolios that are just going to survive and do well no matter what the heck happens in the outside world. And he talks about volatility parity, which I think is a really interesting way of thinking about it, right? If you're invested in the stock market, and that's predominantly your asset, or frankly, in bonds or any of the major asset classes we invest in, you are effectively short volatility, meaning volatility spikes are historically going to be bad for you. And I think we all sort of know that, right? That's why people invest in the VIX. They expect it to go up when the market goes down. And so that's the baseline. Most of us are extraordinarily short volatility. And his whole approach is, well, maybe we should be balancing out all of those short volatility bets with some long volatility bets. And what that means practically is generally using the options market, right? Because that's where we have a market for volatility itself. There really aren't any other markets for it other than the derivatives markets. And so at the simplest level, you can just think of that as hedging your downside risk and also giving yourself the opportunity to participate in outsized upside. That's effectively a convex set of returns, right? You have some baseline beta, but you also give yourself the opportunity to win should things go very wrong or very well.
What's interesting here as you go through that, if more investors do start looking to the options market, does that sort of speed up these pro-cyclical forces that you were talking about earlier? I mean, does this become a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy or start speeding this whole situation up further?
Yeah. And that's one of the really interesting paradoxes of the world that we find ourselves in. Many of the things that we as individual actors, as an investor, as an advisor, the decisions that are the correct decision are actually probably going to make matters worse when they're put together collectively. And, you know, I'm not a policymaker. I'm not here to say, and the solution to solving the global financial system is X. I think that's a little bit above my pay grade, right? So I'm really just observing what I see out there. But your point is correct. Many of the things that we're doing, leaning on the options market, learning how to understand volatility and risk better, using passive vehicles to, you know, get that low cost exposure to our client, for our clients, many of those things are in fact going to accelerate this feature, this pro cyclicality in the market, this enhancement of the fat tails. However, I don't actually think that that means you shouldn't do it, because the alternative is what? Sitting cash. And I don't think any advisor thinks that's the right thing to do either. So given that this is the nature of the market, our job as investors and advisors is to do the best thing for our portfolios and our clients' portfolios. I think you still have to be invested. The challenge is really questioning your models.
One thing that I love that you said in the piece is that investors really need to check our preconceptions at the door about how markets used to work, and start understanding some of these, you know, flow-driven and you know, how options are impacting the market and these pro-cyclical forces. I thought that was a really good point. Dave, before we move on here, because I do want to get to a couple of ETF topics, I have to ask you, one thing that caught my attention in your piece is you were talking about you know, all of these pro-cyclical forces, and you said changes in monetary policy and the rise of high-frequency trading have changed the game, to say nothing of the rise of ETFs and passive investing. And it was that last piece on ETFs and passive investing that caught my attention, because it was actually just after I read a Bloomberg piece titled Wall Street Rebels Warn of Disastrous $11 Trillion Index Boom, which, to be honest, I thought we were kind of done with the ETF and index fearmongering. But then I saw you say that. What did you mean by that?
Well, again, this comes down to the let's look at the actual math before, and but without putting a lot of emotion behind it. I don't think big hyperbolic headlines about, you know, indexing being worse than Marxism, to bring back an old one, I don't think they do anything for us, right? There's a lot of like the sky is falling. That being said, it is unquestionable that the presence of indexes changes how the markets work. And you know, I probably the easiest to read piece on this would be Corey Hofstein's Liquidity Cascades piece. He has a wonderful couple pages in there where he walks through it. But these aren't controversial statements, right? I mean, you can simply ask the question, okay, well, if a large percentage of the assets in the world are indexed and those are equities, and pick any individual component of returns. Let's just talk about dividends, right? So company A at the top of the curve pays a dividend. Company B at the bottom of the curve doesn't. Well, net-net, what ends up happening in an index world is all of that dividend money flows from the high-yield companies to go to the zero-yield companies because of reinvestment. So think about the long-term implications of that are you're actually mushing the returns of the high yielders and the low yielders together because you're constantly reallocating from high yield to low yield stocks. There are about a dozen things like that that have interesting implications for how markets work. I don't think it means that the entire world comes collapsing down, but they, on average, when you roll it all together, have a pro-cyclical effect on markets. It means that winners tend to run longer. You know, and you know, losers, yeah, they can fall apart very quickly. But more and more, what we're seeing is this endless bid on the market is in fact supported by index flows. And so I think the real learning here is we're increasingly in a flows-driven market, not a fundamentals-driven market. And perhaps that's controversial, but I think most of the evidence would suggest that flows on a day-to-day basis are much more important than any given earnings announcement.
Well, Dave, I really enjoyed the piece. Extremely thought-provoking. For listeners, go check it out. Again, it's at etftrends.com. You won't be disappointed. Dave, just a couple of minutes left here. Let's go back to where I'm much more comfortable talking in the shallow end of the pool. I'll toss two quick ETF topics at you. And the first is this trend we're seeing of social influencers getting involved in ETFs. The latest came last week with this launch of the AdvisorShares Gerber Kawasaki ETF, ticker GK. This is managed by Ross Gerber. He currently has like 160,000 Twitter followers, gets a ton of media attention. And then, of course, earlier this year, Barstool's Dave Portnoy got involved with the VanEck Vector Social Sentiment ETF, ticker Buzz. He was promoting the index behind that. Roundhill had Joe Pompliano. He's the brother of Anthony Pompliano. He has like 270,000 Twitter followers. So he's involved with the Roundhill MVP ETF. And then last week, Roundhill also launched the Ball Metaverse ETF, ticker Meta, great ticker. And this involves Matthew Ball, who's a well-known technical expert in the space. And he has like 75,000 Twitter followers. The question I have for you is, what's your take on this trend of these sort of known entities putting their name behind an ETF?
For the most part, I'm pretty cynical, and I think of this as marketing. And of course, that marketing will work to some extent. I mean, I think Buzz has $250 million in it right now. Mm-hmm. So obviously, the buzz of a marketing brand like that does matter. I'm a little skeptical. Obviously, all of these things ultimately come down to, is there actually any investment IP here that adds value to the investor? At the end of the day, that's the only thing that actually matters. Are you justifying your fee by providing more value? It will be remain to be seen. I generally think that something like the Gerber ETF, that probably makes a little more sense because at least people can identify with perhaps an investing ethos. I'm not sure that you can say the same thing about a lot of the social media only type stars as opposed to folks who are kind of professional investors that folks understand. So I remain skeptical, and the proof will always be in the pudding.
So we're not going to see a Dave Nottig ETF anytime soon?
Not while I'm alive.
All right. And then briefly, one other ETF topic I really wanted to get your take on because we haven't had a chance to discuss this. This Engine Number One ETF, the Transform 500 ETF, ticker VOTE, which is basically an S&P 500 index fund, costs 5 basis points, but the difference is you have an activist investor behind it, an Engine Number One, who's going to attempt to engage with companies to enact change. What'd you think about this one?
I absolutely love this. So, I mean, I've been saying for a number of years that I think we will reach a point where people pick their S&P 500 fund based on the voting system. And I got laughed at 10 years ago when I put that up on a slide. And this is ultimately where we're headed. And the folks behind this fund, I think, are great. Jennifer Grancio, ex-BlackRock, one of the sharpest people in the business, and a whole crew of folks behind that. And I love this idea of an activist investor literally just for putting it all out there, putting not only their money where their mouth is, but inviting everybody to come along with them and then making a lot of noise, right? I think this is a fantastic way for people who really believe in long-term change through activism to put their money where their mouth is and get behind something like this. And, I think it's also really important to point out this is a very well-connected group of people behind this. So their ability to not only just raise a bunch of money, but to actually get access to these boardrooms, and more importantly, to get access to other institutional investors who may not be their investors, like, say, BlackRock, to go along with them on specific company votes, I think it's fantastic.
Couldn't agree more. I think listeners know I'm typically skeptical of ESG ETFs as a whole, but in my mind, this is the way you go about doing it. This is an active way to engage companies. I love it. Dave, excellent stuff as always. Thank you for joining me this week.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'll be back anytime.
That was ETF Trends, Dave Nottig.